I'm calling the Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, January 16th, and the time is 3:30. Present committee members, Vice Chair Senator Fred Dyson, also committee members Senator French, Senator Machicki, Senator Bishop. Senator Fairclough is excused. She's currently attending another committee meeting and will be joining us later. And I believe Senator McGuire will be along shortly. Great. Let me also introduce some of our staff that's here helping us. My committee aide for this committee is Sharon Long. We have our recording the historical record for us, Ann Krekelberg. Thank you, Ann, for doing that. Ann's been doing this for many years, so she does a great job. And facilitating the audio conference are Betsy and Henry back here behind the screen. So welcome, everyone. On the agenda today, we are going to be beginning an informational review of the natural gas needs in our state. But before we do that, I'll do a little bit of housekeeping kinds of things. First of all, please silence your cell phones. Reminders to the committee, questions to the participants today and at subsequent meetings should go through the chair. I've already introduced my staff person for this committee, Sharon Long. She'll carry all communications, such as notes and so forth, documents should go through Sharon. My goal for this committee is to begin punctually at 3:30 for each meeting, and our time of adjournment is 5 p.m. There may be a few opportunities to take testimony from folks and presentations that will go on into the evening. But I will make sure that everyone is notified well ahead of time if that happens. And that would only occur on a Monday or a Wednesday, not a Friday. Let's see. I'm also hopeful that committee members will make full use of iPads and electronic documents. If you'd like to do that, please feel free to bring your iPads to committee meetings. Just be sure to silence all those keyboard sounds that can be so distracting. Any questions from committee members about operations? Yes, Senator French.
Madam Chair, you mentioned Friday meetings. Is it my understanding or misunderstanding that we're meeting Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday normally as a committee?
Our committee times are Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, yes. Yes. Well, thanks for that clarifying question. Great. Well, today we're going to be looking at natural gas needs, you know, and as Alaskans, I think we understand that basic need for energy better than most Americans. This is not a new issue to Alaskans. And in your booklet today, I've included a document from the Institute of Social and Economic Research dated 2006, South Central Energy Summary. And they were forecasting actually a shortage of natural gas pretty accurately in 2006. Interestingly, the 2007 25th Legislature Resources Committee began its committee meetings on this very same topic. So here we are 6 years later addressing the very same topic again in Senate Resources. So we're beginning a series of presentations today entitled Who's Keeping the Lights and Heat On? The Problems and Solutions. So today we're going to be taking a look basically at the problem, some of the descriptions of the problems. And I want to welcome today Peter Stokes with Petrotechnical Resources Alaska. Mr. Stokes is going to be presenting studies that he's been doing on the Cook Inlet natural gas supply shortage. This will be an update. There was a previous study done, and PRA has updated that information. So, Mr. Stokes, welcome to the committee, and I'll let you go ahead and begin. There is a handout for you and an overhead of your presentation. So, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators of the committee, my name is Pete Stokes, and I am a petroleum engineer and a commercial analyst working with Petrotechnical Resources of Alaska, PRA for short. And as was stated, I'll be updating the study that the utilities in South Central, NSTAR, Chugach, and MLNP commissioned PRA to do back in 2009. They had us do an update in 2012. So I'll be talking a little bit about the 2010 study and then going into the update that we found in 2012. Today I'll be talking about the South Central Alaska gas supply and demand forecast for 2012 through 2020, discuss possibilities that would allow us to meet the South Central demand during that period, and then briefly talk about the Singsa gas storage project that's recently been commissioned and is operating there in the mouth of the Kenai River.
Excuse me, Mr. Stokes. I wanted to ask the record to reflect that we've been joined by Senator McGuire. Go ahead and proceed.
So as I stated in my earlier remarks, PRA was commissioned to do a supply study and compare that to demand back in 2009. We published this study in 2010, and it allowed the utilities to better understand what the supply was for their gas needs. They're very gas dependent and wanted to be able to see what the future held for gas supplies, and they wanted to understand a little bit better about what the DNR, who published a study in 2009, they wanted that report analyzed and compared to what we found. And it also will help them in if they are going to have shortfalls, the timing of having shortfalls in Cook Inlet. So we looked at the DNR report that was published in 2009, and they did a forecast of the existing wells, the orange there, and then they layered on some additional potential material balance that you could achieve through compression down to very low pressures in the reservoir. They showed some geologic potential pay. That they did an exhaustive study of several of the fields in Cook Inlet and identified areas that potentially could have additional gas. And then they did some potential analysis, and they feathered it in to meet the demand of what our needs are in Cook Inlet, just sort of showing that there was resource available that could be proven up and developed. So PRA's study was limited to looking at the current well set back in 2009, and we did decline curve analysis very similar to what the DNR did, and we compared our analysis to theirs, and you can see, although there's a few annual up and downs, in general it's pretty comparable, and it shows that for the existing well set we are showing a steady decline for the next 10 years through 2020. The summary, we also looked at what wells had been developed and the amount of gas that had been developed from 2000 to 2009, and used that information to sort of project what additional development would be required to meet shortfalls 2013 and beyond. We projected that if you wanted to meet sort of the demand that the DNR had said could be met, there would have to be significant capital spent in order to do that. And using well statistics from wells that were developed from 2000 to 2009, we estimated it would take 185 similar wells to be developed during that period. And just nominally taking a well cost to be $10 million or $15 million, you're talking really two to nearly $3 billion of capital invested in well costs to meet that shortfall. In 2011, DNR did a follow-on study to their geologic study of resources available, and they looked at costs of developing this undeveloped gas in Cook Inlet. And they concluded in their study that the Cook Inlet Basin, with investment in exploration and production, is capable of meeting the needs through the 2018 to 2020 time frame. But they also concluded that if the investments were not made in lockstep with demand, it would result in the need for alternative sources coming into Cook Inlet sooner. So once again, in 2012, the utilities asked PRA to update the study that we had in 2010. And in summary, what we found is that there was drilling and compression additions done since the 2010 study, and it now moved the predicted shortfall from 2013 to 2014 just because of the additional wells. Once again, the original study was just looking at the existing wells. There was additional wells and compression added, so it pushed back the timing of the shortfall. Just to give a little historical context to the production in Cook Inlet, you can see that from 2000 to 2005, we were at a very high level of around 200 BCF a year of production in Cook Inlet. And we supported not only the utilities for their customers in South Central, the heating and the electrical requirements, but also there were two industrial export plants located in Nikiski. It was the Agrium Chemical Plant, which is originally the Union Oil Collier Plant, and then the LNG export plant, both located in Nikiski. Well, in 2007, Agrium shut down because they could not source gas at the price they needed to continue operations. So you can see that that combined with the sort of the last few exports from LNG has caused the production to fall off from 2006 to 2012. Well, the current LNG license expires in March of 2013, and we're not, I don't believe anything publicly has been said about if they will extend or if how that plant will be used in the future. I'll discuss a little bit about what we assume in our supply forecast. In 2014 and beyond, what we're seeing, the production will pretty much be for the utilities in South Central, the Tesoro refinery, and then fuel for the oil and gas facilities and mining fuel in the out years. So for the sort of the plateau on our demand here from 2014 to 2019, we see once again NSTAR being a major consumer, Chugach Electric, HEA, MEA, MLNP make up another 35 to 40% of the demand in that period of time. Tesoro Refinery, we're showing, makes up about 7% of that demand. And then the providing fuel for the oil and gas production facilities is about 13%.
Yes, Mr. French.
Just on that point, thank you, Madam Chair. A question about future demand. Does this assume any power from, say, Watonna Dam?
Senator French, to the Chair, this does not include anything for Watonna Dam. This assumes that they generate the power and provide space heat to their customers from natural gas.
Yes.
Correct.
So Watonna Dam would upend this dramatically.
Depending on the timing of when it comes on, this period that we're seeing, I don't believe Watonna Dam would impact, but you're correct. It would supply a lot of additional electrical energy that could displace this in the future.
Probably back out Chugach Electric, ONG, Fuel and Gas, and HEA, MEA at least, and maybe even half of MLNP.
that was not part of our study, so we really didn't address it in this time frame.
Yes, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. On this one where it says NLP, Native Load, what does Native Load mean?
This is their, basically their load in Anchorage without without supporting other utilities. And a lot of what they use for gas, they actually own in the Beluga River field.
Is Native in that context of terminal work? Is that a normal way that term is used?
That was not my term. It was what was provided to me by the utilities.
Excuse me, Mr. Stokes, let the record reflect that Senator Fairclough has joined the committee. Go ahead.
Building a little bit more on the graph on this slide, you can see in 2012, tailing down to 2013, we assume that the LNG exports will discontinue after March of 13. Once again, that is a bit of an unknown, but that was the assumption in our demand. And you can see the ramp up in 2019 to 2020 assumes that there will be a gas pipeline to Donlin Creek and supplying fuel for Donlin Creek. So the reason the utilities were interested in 2010 and updating in 2012, the knowledge of what the future supply looks like, is basically they're very dependent on gas. NSTAR is 100% dependent on gas to provide gas to their customers for space heating needs. Chugach Electric currently uses 90% of gas for the fuel in of their generators. And MLMP is once again about 88% used for generation. The other 10% for those utilities are either maybe hydro or some fuel. On the right side, you can just see what the 2012 consumption prediction was for each of the utilities when we did this study update. And then this is what the utilities had under contract and not under contract for their demand going forward. And as you can see, they're very concerned that they were not able to secure contracts to know that they would have gas going out into the future. This may have changed a bit, but this was as of sort of June 2012. So once again, we updated our study of the existing wells and fields in Cook Inlet as of June of 2012's production. We did on the major fields, well by well, decline curve analysis. On the smaller fields, we just did field-wide decline curve analysis. We summed them all together. It shows from the existing well set, from the existing fields that we're producing, we're looking at a 16 to 70% annual decline going out into the future. Now, once again, this does not include future developments or future exploration development that could be found with the current exploration activity. It's just the existing wells that we have. So in 2012, the study shows that we expect to see a shortfall in 2014. Whereas the 2010 study forecasted the need of 13 to 14 completions a year added into our well set, what we've observed in the last 3 years is about 5 to 8 wells being added, completed annually. Now, there have been additional exploration wells drilled, but what I'm counting here are only the wells that have actually been produced and are currently hooked up to the pipelines.
Yes, Senator Dyson.
Thanks for helping us. Does your analysis, or could it include an evaluation of the individual wells or fields? Some of them, I think, are being a bit more prolific than others.
Senator Dyson, through the chair, what we did was once again looked at each individual well and forecasted it based on the performance of the well.
Performance of past wells?
No, of current producing wells.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Not the new ones that have been drilled but are not on stream yet?
Correct. And there are a handful of wells that we're aware of that are not included in this study. We have done some sensitivities to try and account for that, just to show the impact of additional development.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So once again, just looking at the supply of gas from existing wells in Cook Inlet and comparing that to the demand, we're showing in 2014 projected shortfalls, and then they increase annually from there on. And it's very similar to the graph that showed the uncontracted amount of gas that the utilities require. So this is a combination of drilling results that we observed in the study that was from looking at wells from 2001 to 2009, and then we added in the three years following the dates of the study. And as you can see, for the first 9 or 9.5 years, we saw on average about 12.3 wells completed per year and added to the well set in Cook Inlet. And on average, each of these new wells added about 3.6 million standard cubic feet per day. Now, focusing on the last 2.5 years of that time frame, from 2007 to 2009, we saw 34 wells completed, which was on average about 13.5 wells a year. Notably, the initial production of each of those wells was a little bit lower than the 9-year average. And then in the last 3 years, we've observed 5 wells, 6 wells, and 8 wells being added each year. And once again, in November 2010 to October 11, we had less wells, and they weren't as good. So it just depends on where the wells were drilled in the basin. But by and large, you're seeing we're not at the 13 to 14 wells completed a year that we really need to mitigate the shortfall. So one of the sensitivities we did was, what if we added 10 million a day each year from 2013 to 2019? That would sort of equate to 3 or 4 new wells being completed each year. And once again, we see that it's not as big, but we still see a shortfall as early as 2014. A second sensitivity, where you added each year 20 million a day, which would equate to about 6 to 8 new wells a year, which is similar to what we've seen in the last 3 years. We've seen anywhere from 5 to 8 wells. The shortfall is pushed out a year, but it still occurs in 2015 and stair steps up through 2020. Now, this could certainly be changed by near-term infill developments above and beyond 20 million a day per year due to the activities of some of the new players and the old Hillcorp and ConocoPhillips, Buccaneer, Armstrong, and others, and I'll talk more about that in a couple of slides here. So To meet this shortfall or the demand that we see in South Central with beyond just what we have in current wells, the options that could occur would be infill development, which would be developing additional gas from fields that are currently produced by Hillcorp, ConocoPhillips, Armstrong, Buccaneer, and others. Exploration, both in the onshore, we've got Nordak, Apache, Buccaneer exploring onshore. Offshore, we've got two jackups, Fury and Buccaneer, each have a jackup that are now in the inlet. Apache is doing a large 3D offshore program. So there will no doubt be discoveries made offshore in time. The in-state gas line, ASAP, that's an option to try and to mitigate the shortfall. And then gas imports are another thing that we need to consider for making sure that we don't have shortfalls. Talking about each one of these now, for infill development, Hillcorp's recently taken over the Chevron assets in Cook Inlet, and they publicly said that they're going to spend $200 million in 2012 to develop oil and gas. They also said they'd likely spend $150 million a year over the two following years. And this would be a marked increase over what Chevron and Marathon had spent in the last few years. One development that's not in our analysis, it's just recently hooked up last month, is there's a well at Red Pad that's now producing. This statement was talking about developing oil and gas, and it didn't really say how much they were going to spend on oil or how much you're going to spend on gas. They're just going to be spending that amount of money in capital.
A quick question.
Yes, Senator French.
Madam Chair. Infield development, is that what you would also call a development well?
Senator French, through the chair. That is what I'd be looking at, is if you've already got a field and you're doing some delineation or infill development, yes.
I was doing some reading preparing for this hearing, and I looked at your 2010 report, and your 2010 report on page 5 made a fascinating point that I didn't realize, and that is that development wells in Cook Inlet have a 90% success rate. When you drill a development well, you're going to hit gas. So it's a fairly, I mean, you can know to an almost certainty that if you can spend money on a development well, you're going to hit gas. It's an interesting piece of work you did back in 2010 for us. Thank you.
Did you have an answer to that?
Just a response. Okay. The observation I would have, Senator French, is if you have a development and you keep drilling wells and you run out of wells to drill, then whether it's a 90% or 80%, I mean, it's if you don't have prospects to drill, you just don't drill, or not prospects, but locations to drill, you probably don't drill them.
I agree. I'm sorry, I agree, but I'm just going from your report. You said there were 97 wells permitted and drilled, 87 of them were completed, 90% success rate. I thought that was remarkable. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dyson, did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm trying to think whether my question's been answered.
Okay.
Pretty similar. So as I understand that reservoir, there's stratigraphic traps on several levels down through it. And is it indeed likely, Peter, that the producers, you know, when the strata they're producing, that they will go on down and to some deeper structures? I realize that's a question you can't answer, but from your expertise.
Senator Dyson, through the chair, my observation would be that if they're going to be able to drill and find gas, that they will do it. And typically, they drill through all of the estimated productive horizons and complete wells to maximize their production. I've not looked at any recent wells other than from afar, and some wells come in good and some do not. I haven't looked at them in further detail than that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Stokes, just to keep us all on time, we have about 15 minutes left, and then we have another speaker coming. So
all right.
Go ahead and proceed.
I'll continue on.
Thank you.
So ConocoPhillips has recently drilled two wells at Beluga River. One was good, one was not good. So that's not a very good average if you just take two wells. Buccaneer is currently completing Kenai Loop number 4, following up the Kenai Loop number 1, which was good. The Kenai Loop number 3 was not good. Armstrong's permitted four wells at North Fork there. They've drilled, as I understand it, a couple of them, and then there's other smaller companies that are doing additional development. But unless more or high-rate gas wells are developed in fill, this is not really going to solve our shortfall.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
Question. Mr. Stokes, how would you define a successful infield development gas well?
Senator Machicki, through the chair, what I would say would be a well that it comes in at 2 to 3 million a day. I mean, it depends on the well. I mean, if you're drilling a very expensive $20 million well on the west side of the inlet and it comes in at a million a day, I would say that's not very successful. You wouldn't continue to do that. If you're drilling some shallow targets and maybe get a million a day, that might be very, very successful. It all depends on how deep and the cost of the well. Another option is, once again, the exploration. Onshore, we're looking at activities going on. Hillcorp's doing a 3D program at Deep Creek. Nordak is delineating Shadura and exploring. They recently drilled a Tiger Eye prospect on the west side of Cook Inlet. Buccaneer is planning exploration near Homer. Cook Inlet Energy is exploring on the west side. And Apache's doing this large 3D that is onshore as well as offshore. And if successful, this could impact the timing of our shortfall, but it needs to occur quickly, and they need to have success.
Ms. Gary, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Dyson.
I assume a major component of this is how close those wells are to infrastructure, i.e. pipeline systems. And that's going to influence how quickly and how much it's going to cost. Am I right?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, that's very correct. I mean, the Kenai Loop well discovered and developed by Buccaneer is right literally in the city of Kenai, and it's very close.
Lot, right?
Yes. And if you could have all of those right near a pipeline, it'd be ideal. But a lot of those areas around infrastructure have already been pretty well explored.
So you might, in the course of this, or tell us how we could differentiate between the ones that have infrastructure close and not, because of what that could mean to the development and solving our problems, maybe in another venue or something.
Another avenue of getting new gas into Cook Inlet is the offshore exploration that's going on. As I noted, Fury is drilling exploration wells with the first jackup in the inlet, the Spartan 151. They announced a discovery at Kitchen Lights 1 last year, did not complete the well. They drilled and suspended Kitchen Lights number 2 and the Sidetrack 2A this last summer season. Buccaneers mobilized a second jackup, the Endeavor, and plans to drill at Cosmopolitan this winter. And as I mentioned earlier, Apache's shooting 3D offshore, and that could lead to future exploration drilling. In our estimation, the timing of gas discovered and produced from offshore exploration is likely to be 3 to 5 years after the discovery due to the permitting and construction lead times. Another option we noted is the Alaska Standalone Gas Pipeline, the ASAP. Basically, the latest estimate is that there could be gas to South Central by 2020 at the earliest. So obviously, it would not have an impact on any shortfalls before that time. The final note would be to bring gas into Cook Inlet via LNG or compressed natural gas. And we note that this is an option. There is a utility study group that is studying that option. I believe they're going to present to you later on that. LNG is a commodity that's out there. We could bring it to Cook Inlet, potentially used in the Nikiski plant or another facility to regasify. LNG from the North Slope is being looked at, certainly for Fairbanks. If we were to try and meet the shortfall needs for South Central, it could result in a large, even hundreds of truckloads a day to meet some of the shortfalls that we would predict in Cook Inlet. Compressed natural gas is another option that's being looked at, and the idea there was it might be a cheaper option than LNG. But as I said, there is a study group that is looking at that, and I think they're about ready to start making some recommendations on the way forward. So with timing being of essence, I mean, we have time to meet LNG or CNG imports to fulfill short-term needs until we have exploration success or we have gas coming down via ASAP. So in summary then, we don't feel that infill drilling is going to really meet demands past 2015. The onshore exploration, it's not proven. If it's successful and near infrastructure, it could impact the timing of our shortfall. We feel that offshore exploration, once again, it's not proven, and then it would take 3 to 5 years to bring online after discovery. The ASAP line will be operational 2020 and beyond. Importing of LNG or CNG, it could well bridge the demand shortfall until this exploration is successful or we have in-state gas. Just a quick update on the Singsa project. This project is a commercial storage project in which five horizontal wells were drilled and compression has been installed. It's down in the mouth of the Kenai River in the old Cannery Loop field. It allows for 11 BCF of active storage, and it allows the utilities to meet 140 million a day of peaking in the wintertime.
Yes, Senator French.
Sorry, a question about Singsa. We several years ago, all of us recognized there was, deep and long-seated need for a storage project. We worked together and created that. And I'm wondering, one, what would happen if we doubled the size of Singsa? Would that allow us to meet peaking winter demands for a longer period of time, or would it just have no net effect because you haven't increased the amount of gas coming out of the ground? You just stored it up during the summer for winter use.
Senator French, through the chair. One thing that you need to have on a storage project is the right size container to where when you put gas in, you can pull it out as fast as you need it. If you double,
I mean more wells. I don't mean one huge cavern, but I mean five more wells, for example.
Yeah. Well, if you really the five wells are all in this 11 BCF container. If you found another container, it would allow you to store more gas, but as you point out, it doesn't increase the supply. It just allows you to inject gas in the summertime for peak demand needs in the wintertime.
And is Singsa full? My understanding is that it's about half full. Do you know?
Yeah, this is the first year that they've used it, so they were getting the container filled up, and it is about half full, and they'll. By next winter season, they'll have put enough gas in it
to fill it up.
But once again, it's just a storage vehicle, so or vessel, so you're using it using it up in the wintertime. So once again,
Mr. Stokes,
yes.
Senator Bishop had a question.
I'm sorry.
It's probably premature, but I just wanted to ask the question anyway. There's probably not enough baseline data yet to say for sure whether this reservoir is what they were advertising.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, I've not really studied this in detail, but I do know it's being used right now to meet peaking demands. It was, I believe, used in December, and so I mean, all of the equipment is working as advertised. The wells are working. It's just we need to make sure it's full when you need to use it in the wintertime.
Senator Dyson had a question also, Mr. Stokes.
With the huge delta between oil prices and gas prices, we always worry that producers will go after oil at the expense of gas, and of course we have a public interest in seeing more gas. Is that a possibility in Cook Inlet that the producers are quietly more interested in gas or in oil than gas? And if so, how could we build incentives or whatever that would make sure they stay focused on what our concern is, which is gas for our own people?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, we did not really study that in this report. I think that prudent operators or investors are looking at what is the best return on their investment. And obviously, if they can make more drilling an oil well than a gas well, then sort of the right thing to do would be to drill the oil well, which is not necessarily going to solve our gas needs. On the other hand, in Cook Inlet, we found a lot of gas drilling for oil. So just the fact that they're drilling is a good sign.
Thank you.
Mr. Stokes, we're closing in on the last 3 minutes. Could I just ask a question at this point?
Yes.
What do you estimate the time and the cost would be to bring in a first load of liquefied natural gas? Do you have any information on that, or should we ask someone else?
Madam Chair, I think probably the group that you have in next week will be able to answer that. I have not been directly involved in that group. It would probably be in the 2 to 3 year time frame, from what I understand, from what I've read.
Great, thanks.
Okay. Well, I just have a summary slide then. We don't have large discoveries in Cook Inlet with the current activity that can be brought on in the 1 to 2 year time frame. We're looking at a shortfall of natural gas not meeting demand as early as 2014 or 15. LNG or compressed natural gas import is the only certain method that the utilities have to know that they can continue to use gas to supply their customers. SINGSA storage is capable of storing gas in Cook Inlet that's produced in the summer and needed in the wintertime, and it also would be a way of handling any gas that you bring into the inlet.
Very good. Thank you. Committee members, any further questions for Mr. Stokes? Great. Oh, yes. Senator Machiki.
Just a comment. This has been very helpful. I think it's helpful for the public to learn that activity doesn't necessarily result in production. And although we appreciate all the work that's going on in Cook Inlet, that we need to remain concerned and work toward helpful solutions on providing gas for Alaskans. So,
very good.
Thank you.
And that was actually the motivation for bringing Mr. Stokes today and the study. Our next speaker, and thank you, Mr. Stokes, we appreciate it very much. Our next speaker actually is going to focus now on the interior and even broaden out to the entire state. This is Dr. Anthony Scott, senior economist and policy analyst at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He is going to be available online, and his PowerPoint will be projected. Let's do a brief at ease while we switch all the technology. Come back to order. This is Senate Resources coming back to order. And online with us is Dr. Anthony Scott with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Welcome, Dr. Scott. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Anthony Scott. I enjoy a research position with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I've been there since February. Prior to that, I managed the commercial section of the Division of Oil and Gas. So I'm going to present some results today of a study that I've been working on with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power for the better part of this last year, looking at trying to provide some apples-to-apples comparisons of a range of different energy solutions for Fairbanks that are often referred to and considered. On slide two, you can see the list of projects that we looked at. There are always other projects and other variations that one can imagine, but this is the list that we tried to look at. And we looked at it from a particular perspective, which was really what the delivered cost of energy to Fairbanks consumers would be off of these projects. So we did not look at things like cash flow to the state off of any of these projects or any of these or any broader sort of policy issues that certainly you folks have to address and consider. So in some ways it was narrow, but in some ways it was also broad. In terms of these projects, I need to explain just a little bit about how we went about doing an apples-to-apples comparison. We did not optimize anything. So in some ways what we did is we abstracted the projects from the project proponents. We are not identifying any particular project sponsor as moving these forward, and that has some consequences in terms of how we modeled them. We make similar financing assumptions across these projects. For example, we run sensitivities, but when we run a sensitivity, we make similar financing assumptions across all projects. We use the same cost indices to bring the project sponsor's cost estimates up to date in 2012 dollars and then project them forward. Some of the projects have particular innovative proposals for how they would like to proceed. For example, the ASAP project has suggested using state royalty gas for line pack. That's not something that we did in this case. The 12-inch fit-for-purpose project proposed by Arctic Fox suggested purchasing gas that had already been treated by the producers on the North Slope in a bundled commodity sense. That's certainly potentially possible, but we didn't do that. Again, what we were trying to do was consider projects on an infrastructure basis and then think of them on, provide a way of comparing them on an apples-to-apples basis. Before I go into results and descriptions just a little bit about what the projects are, I wanted to briefly thank a number of folks who helped with the study by providing data. The people at Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation were particularly helpful, Jim Dodson and Steve Hagenson in particular. Folks at AGDC were also kindly provided key underlying data. Folks at Energia Cura in Fairbanks provided some of the underlying data that they use for their project. I consulted with experts at AEA on the Susitna Dam. I spent an awful lot of time with the people who are suggesting that we take a hard look at high voltage direct current transmission of electricity off the North Slope, Mira Kohler at AVAC, and particularly Robert Johnson, who's with Marsh Creek. we couldn't have done any of this work without these individuals and others, considerable investment of time, and we're grateful. Obviously, remaining errors are particularly mine, so what did we look at? We looked at, on slide two, we looked at trucking LNG off the North Slope. We looked at different configurations of a bullet line project. When Bob Swenson was managing the project, he looked at not just 500 million a day project configuration, which is what the AGDC is currently pursuing, but also smaller throughput configurations at 250 million a day, more or less meeting the entire rail belt energy demands, as well as larger throughput configurations at a BCF a day. We looked at a spur line off of a major gas sale. That the assumption is that a major gas sale, as we model it, is an LNG project as opposed to an overland project into North America, and that will have consequences for pricing in state. We looked at a small diameter 12-inch fit-for-purpose pipeline from the North Slope to Fairbanks to meet Fairbanks' needs. We looked at the Beluga to Fairbanks option, so piping gas from Cook Inlet north into Fairbanks. We, for Grins, looked at the possibility of heating by wire. So we looked at the Susitna-Watonna project. And we also looked at a project configuration of high voltage direct current, which would provide both electricity and heat by wire to Fairbanks. I need to underscore for a minute that we included these two electric projects for comparative purposes, but they're different. Meeting electricity needs and doing electricity planning is really, in many ways, beyond the scope of this work because it requires so many project integration considerations that kind of exceeded the scope of our ability to address in this study. But for comparative purposes, they're included, and they shed some light, I think. Finally, we looked at the possibility, which was actually the initial justification for the study to begin with in terms of its funding, looked at the possibility of making liquids out of coal, a coal-to-liquids facility located in the interior. I need to talk a little bit more about methodology before we get to results. One of the things that drives the results in this project critically is that we're focusing substantially on the commodity price piece of things. I'm now on slide three. Often you will see projects presented to you in terms of the cost of the infrastructure. And so someone will assume a cost of the commodity, whether it's $2 or $5 or whatever it is, or 50 cents, and then given a fixed assumption on the commodity charge, focus on how to minimize cost of transportation. And while transportation costs are absolutely relevant, they clearly don't tell the whole story. And so some of the results that you'll see in just a minute will be perhaps surprising. They were surprising to me, but they are a result of focusing on commodity pricing regimes within Alaska.
Dr. Scott, excuse me for a moment. Senator Machicki had a question for you.
Dr. Scott, thank you very much. Just a couple of wondering why a couple of alternatives aren't mentioned. One that's sort of painfully obvious is imported LNG and regas. And the second is the potential for Nanana Basin natural gas production. Could you comment?
Through the chair. In effect, I'll present results of the Beluga to Fairbanks project in just a moment. The importing of LNG can be understood in the context of that project in terms of moving gas by pipeline from Cook Inlet into the interior. So in some ways that project gets sort of spanned by the Beluga to Fairbanks work that we've already done. The interior energy development project, I didn't have any public data to work with to try to begin to mock up what that might look like. So at the end of the day, I need to rely substantially on the data that are available in this modeling effort. There are other things that we could have done as well, but significantly it's a limitation of resources is the answer, Senator.
Follow up, Senator Machicki?
I'll just follow up. Just as this is processed, it'd be interesting to see the trucking option going north instead of just coming south. So the Beluga to Fairbanks pipeline is an interesting concept, but LNG could be trucked both ways, so just interested.
Or rail.
Or rail, right.
If you would proceed, Dr. Scott, thank you.
Sure. So this is a simplified, let's look at slide four a little bit. This is worth focusing on for a little while because these are assumptions which will significantly drive the results that you see presented. And these are indeed assumptions, which is to say they are models, they're wrong. This is not what how the future will necessarily unfold. However, the working framework here is data-based. That is, it's based on actual transactions in the market. I think there's a fair amount of empirical support from using this as a starting place. So let me explain. Today on the North Slope, one can purchase stranded gas. It's untreated. That is, the CO2 isn't removed. But one can purchase stranded gas, and there are market transactions on the North Slope for those, for that commodity. Much of that gas is transacted essentially at the formula that you see here. That is, roughly, you take the price of a barrel of ANS oil, multiply by 4.6%, and that will be the price, actually, per MCF of the gas. Where did that formula come from? That formula comes from a DNR settlement for valuing gas that was agreed to in the early 1990s with the North Slope producers. It then became a benchmark for a number of market transactions that have since taken place. So if you look at Norgasco's contracts, for example, for gas on the North Slope, they are priced with reference to this formula. Now, I'm not saying that one cannot do better than what this formula would represent. And indeed, if you look at royalty values and you know enough about how the settlement agreements work, you can back out some of the values for gas being transacted. Some of it differs. Some of it's higher and some of it's lower. But in general, one of the patterns that emerges pretty clearly is you don't purchase gas at a fixed price, at least not today. Gas is indexed, it's typically indexed to oil, and it's indexed to oil at something like this formula. If you look at LNG pricing under long-term, not spot, long-term contracts in the Asian Pacific. It's currently undergoing change some. The sort of historical industry standard looks something like the formula given here, which is more or less take ANS, or a waterborne crude, multiply by 14.5% or thereabouts, add 90 cents, and that will get you more or less the price per MMBTU in Asia. A formula much like this, a little bit more aggressive, that is somewhat higher prices, was used by the AGDC in their work that they presented to you in 2011. There's other support for this kind of a pricing arrangement as well. This gas strategies, which was hired by the Palin administration as part of the AGEA process, suggested similar formulas going forward for pricing. Wood Mackenzie as well has suggested similar formulas for pricing going forward. Prices may soften. You hear a lot about that. It's entirely possible. If they soften too much, however, I would suggest that the prospects for LNG export dim considerably off of any project. So for modeling purposes, this is what I'm using here. Finally, I'd like to talk about modeling Fairbanks heating oil, because it turns out that Fairbanks heating oil can be correlated very tightly to ANS crude oil prices. And basically, the formula for retail Fairbanks heating oil will be more or less take the price of a barrel of ANS crude, multiply by 22.5%, add $4.20 to it, and that will get you more or less the price per MMBTU, not per gallon, per MMBTU of heating oil. You can see here where I'm now using ANS oil prices as the common denominator to begin to look at these different commodity markets. The next slide, slide 5, basically takes these formula, just to give you an illustration, it takes these formula and runs historical actual ANS oil prices through each of the formula to produce different price paths. So the blue line is actually what ANS oil prices were. The red line is modeled Fairbanks heating oil prices as a function of ANS oil prices. In Fairbanks, right? The green line is the cost of LNG in South Korea as a function of that formula. And the purple line represents the cost at Prudhoe Bay, in essence, at Prudhoe Bay, of stranded North Slope gas. And one of the things, of course, the locations of these different commodities are obviously different, but one of the things that sort of jumps off the page is the volatility of the pricing regimes are very different, which means that the risk profiles of projects that access the resource from different places are going to be very different. So, one of the driving assumptions in my work is that there will be, for the projects that export Alaskan gas as LNG, and there are three of them, right? There's the bullet line at 500 million a day. There's the bullet line at a BCF a day, and then there's a major gas sale modeled here, I think, at 3 BCF a day. All of those export projects bring North Slope gas to the LNG market. And my working assumption in every case is that there is no hometown discount. That is to say, a North Slope producer will not sell gas to Alaskans at a discount compared to the value that they could receive if they exported that gas. I base that based really just on sort of economic logic and commercial behavior. If we could receive a hometown discount for hydrocarbons produced on the North Slope, we wouldn't have an interior energy problem. We don't have a hometown discount. There's no reason why we should. I'm not suggesting by any means that the North Slope producers have any sort of obligation for a second to provide a hometown discount to Alaskans. They are doing what they're supposed to do given their obligations to their shareholders. I'm merely trying to point out that modeling a project with the expectation that they would do something other than what was in their commercial interest should make anybody nervous, and I've tried to avoid doing that. So again, I am assuming in my work that there is not a hometown discount, that the producers would not sell in-state if they could make more through export. So let's turn to the results, please, on slide 6. On slide 6, I model all of these projects on a private ownership model. What does that mean? Those of you who've been around gasoline projects for a while will find this familiar. I assume these projects are financed with 70% debt, 30% equity. I assume that the return on equity is 12% debt, is 12%, that the cost of equity is about 6%. I assume no state money. So in this, I'm assuming across the board, apples to apples, all of the projects are privately financed and move forward on private capital. And what you see here then are delivered costs of energy in Fairbanks in the year 2023. This is money of the day, 2023, as a function of real oil prices. Now, that's a little bit complicated, so let me explain, first of all, why 2023. The reason why is because by 2023, all of the projects being modeled here would be online, or any one of them would be online. So I'm trying to avoid discounting future prices back to today, because then you get into weirdness around what that discount rate is and how that discount rate might compare with cost escalation rates and so on. So I won't go into it. But the oil prices that you see along the horizontal axis here, those are real prices per barrel for Alaska North Slope crude. Because again, you can correlate crude oil prices with the gas prices being modeled here. A couple things jump out from the perspective of Fairbanks. First of all, let's talk about some surprising results first. It turns out that for the ASAP project, larger throughput doesn't mean lower prices to Fairbanks. So the purple line, the purple line represents the BCF a day throughput ASAP project. And you'll notice that for oil prices above about $70 a barrel, the delivered cost to Fairbanks consumers is greater than for that red line. And that red line would be the ASAP project, assuming 100% load factor, but the ASAP project at $250 million a day. Now, that's a surprising result. At least it was to me. It's counterintuitive because, as we all know, if you have bigger throughput on the same line, the cost per transportation will drop. And that's true. It will drop. But the cost to consumers will be a function not just of the cost of transportation. It'll also be a function of the cost of the commodity. For the larger configuration project, it hits the LNG export market. And so what happens is Fairbanks consumers end up seeing that LNG export market formula. And it's, as we saw before, it rises much more steeply as a function of oil prices. So at higher oil prices, it ends up that the lower costs get up and end up getting overwhelmed by the increase in the commodity charge. Again, I'm assuming no hometown discount. The black line, this was really where I should have started, and I apologize for not doing so. The black dashed line, and the black dashed line is your heating oil. That's Fairbanks heating oil. That's more or less the status quo. That's what many consumers are relying on today. If an energy project does not come in below that black dashed line, it's not providing energy cost relief. One of the things that we see is that for all of the projects at low enough oil prices, none of them provide material energy cost relief. Actually, the major gas sale does. But other than that, none of them do.
Madam Chair.
Yes, excuse me. Dr. Scott, Senator French has a question.
I'm sorry, and it's a question just about the graph, because you brought up oil prices, and so now it's important for me to understand. The hash marks on the x-axis, on the axis that runs along the bottom of the graph where the oil prices are, which hash mark corresponds to which oil price? Is the oil price to the right of is the oil price to the right of the number or to the left? You see what I mean? $50.
I apologize, Senator French, through the chair for one of Excel's foibles. The labels really are dead center. So rather than it's an unfortunate aspect of the program that I'm.
So I got to make my own hash mark right above the price to indicate.
$50.
Got it.
Is not at a hash mark right or left. Okay. It's right in the middle.
Right in the middle. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, Dr. Scott.
So again, one of the things that we see here in this is that there is, for a privately owned project, if the only goal that we have is providing energy relief for Fairbanks, there's potential risk that indeed the project doesn't provide energy cost relief. Now, we may all believe that oil prices north of $70 are here to stay no matter what. That may be true. I can tell you, and some of you who know me know this well, I've testified in front of this committee about natural gas prices and have been violently and wildly wrong. So I'm really, you know, if I was smart enough to actually predict future oil prices, I wouldn't have to testify in front of you today. So it's a credible possibility. How would that happen? Shale oil takes off worldwide, just like shale gas has. I don't know. Time's getting short, so let's look at. One last thing. That the dotted blue line here, that looks at the cost of HVDC for a project that would essentially meet all of Fairbanks' heating and electrical needs if it were privately funded. In general, heating by wire is not a super-duper proposition, but this is also, again, we're assuming that this is privately financed. You'll see that the Susitna-Watonna project is not on here, and the reason is because the cost of electricity from that project would, once you convert it to MMBTU, kind of blows out the scale. It's, say, 60% higher than anything else on the graph, which is not a knock by any stretch on that project. All it is saying is that the Susitna-Wetana project will be used to generate electricity in the future, and people will use that electricity for lights and so on rather than heating their homes.
Excuse me, Dr. Scott. Senator Machiki has a question for you.
Dr. Scott, one of the what we hear from the public often is we speak in acronyms they don't understand. I'm assuming HVDC is high voltage direct current.
Senator Machiki, through the chair, that's exactly right. And I apologize for using acronyms that I have not properly spelled out. The HVDC project would purchase stranded North Slope gas, would generate electricity in very large turbines at very high efficiencies, and transport that electricity on high voltage direct current lines into the interior, well, into Fairbanks, where the electricity then would be transformed again and into alternating current and made available for consumers.
Thank you very much, Dr. Scott.
Slide 7 shows the public ownership case. In this case, I'm more or less modeling we can call it the Bradley Lake model if you want. I'm assuming 100% state financing for everything. I'm assuming 4% debt for everything. There's no private capital. One of the things, if you toggle back and forth between slide 6 and 7, you see a dramatic reduction in the cost of all of these projects. The cost of delivered energy comes way down for everything. And you also see some of the projects beginning to separate out. And this is a function in part of the fact that these large energy projects are incredibly capital intensive. And if you can reduce the cost of capital across the projects, it makes an enormous difference. Again, what we see is a kind of a clustering of the projects that are using stranded North Slope gas with a fit-for-purpose pipeline in orange, and the small diameter ASAP project and the Fairbanks trucking project are delivering energy basically in parallel kind of cost environment, and they're pretty close together. Given cost uncertainty to date in terms of project scope on any of these, I would suggest, and the assumption that all of these are fully loaded, I would suggest that these are not really distinguishable results across those three projects. The projects that are using North Slope gas in an export function through the LNG markets, again, they're going to parallel each other. They've got much steeper slopes and often deliver more expensive energy than the stranded gas projects. Not always. Again, it depends on oil prices. At some oil prices, the export projects are better, and at others, they're not. But everything starts looking a lot better compared to heating oil. So on slide 8, I wanted to, so the previous two slides have kind of captured a couple of dynamics. One is the importance of how we finance these things. Another is the oil price risk. What the next couple of slides are going to look at is the issue of ramp-up risk, which is to say you build one of these large infrastructure projects and you don't necessarily sign up all of your customers all at once. In fact, you can't sign up your customers all at once. the cost of providing energy in the very first year to your customer will be much higher than it is once your customer base is fully subscribed. Not terribly surprising, but for all of these projects, it's a material risk that needs to get dealt with on a policy level. These are problems that need to get solved. So the ramp-up risk on slide 9, you can see assuming state funding is obviously much less. Again, I'm assuming here $100 oil, that results in the black dashed line for heating oil. You better be below that, otherwise nobody will switch. If your energy solution is not below the black line, why would you convert to natural gas or anything else? You wouldn't do it. So you've got that, your energy solution has got to be not only below that black line, again, assuming you're in a $100 oil price environment, but it's got to be enough below the line such that the customer wants to pay the conversion costs. Revolving loan funds, well, they'll help some. They probably won't solve the problem. In general, you don't face these problems because infrastructure projects like this get built on the basis of very large industrial customers that create the economies of scale such that everybody else wants to get in. Especially when we look at, say, Fairbanks local distribution of gas, it's not quite that favorable of an environment in terms of initial economies of scale. So again, this ramp-up risk needs to be dealt with. People are aware of this, and they're beginning to work on it and look at it, but the more that you can reduce costs through state financing and so on, grants, what have you, the less this ramp-up risk will exist. Slide 10, I won't talk to, but it shows the ramp-up risk as a function of the rate of ramp-up for Fairbanks local gas distribution, as well as the uncertainty in total Fairbanks heating demand. It is remarkable that maybe it's not remarkable. It was news to me that, not having worked on these sorts of issues before, that we don't really know what Fairbanks needs for heating load. Unlike Anchorage, where one can look up the total number of BTUs of natural gas that consumed by just going to NSTAR, fuel oil obviously is consumed in a distributed fashion. So is wood. So are wood pellets, right? People burn coal. We don't know the total heating load in Fairbanks, and as a result of that uncertainty, we can't fully capture what the ramp-up risk is. But again, it matters. Slide 11 just is to provide some scale on the range of the total capital costs associated with each of these projects. Part of the story here is the state is not going to be able to do all of these things. A major gas sale the state simply couldn't do. At $53 billion, it exceeds our capacity. It's certainly for us to do it by ourselves. But it's not that we would want to do all of these projects, but many of these projects are incredibly capital intensive and will stretch the state's credit capacity. And so hard choices are going to need to be made very soon about what it is we want to pursue. And lastly, on slide 12, I just show the modeled start dates of these different projects, which again is something which for the interior is an extremely relevant concern. Success-like case, assuming these projects get built to completion on a reasonable project schedule, these are more or less what one could expect for first relief in the most favorable conditions. Summary, again, the analysis focused on dimensions of project risk. We didn't have a chance to look at capital cost risk or escalation risk and so on, but the full study will does do that, and I'm trying to find time to finish the write-up now. I guess in terms of any of the learnings here, to use an oil company term, a key part of this is that the commodity price terms are crucial. So as we think about any of these solutions, I would urge you to focus particularly on, well, what are the sales terms? What's the price that is being secured? What's the duration of those pricing terms? At what events do they get renegotiated? Are the pricing terms portable from one project to another? It's critically important, I would urge, that those considerations get nailed down as soon as possible. There's nothing keeping anybody from negotiating gas sales contracts, for example, today. If you're relying on a project that needs stranded North Slope gas, people can and have negotiated those terms. And they should be negotiated at the earliest possible moment, especially if the assumption is that there will be a hometown discount. I'm not suggesting that that would be impossible, especially with state money, but if you want a hometown discount and you're using state money as a carrot to get it, you want to negotiate your discount up front before you spend your carrot. The time to negotiate those gas supply agreements is on the front end rather than the back end. That concludes my remarks. I'm sorry, it took all of our time.
Thank you, Dr. Scott. Let me ask the committee members, any questions for Dr. Scott? Senator Machicki.
Yes. Just a quick one, Dr. Scott. Your coal to liquids delivered cost of energy price is the lowest in both cases, but dramatically lower at higher fuel prices under state ownership. Is there a reason you didn't include the ramp-up risk of that project?
Yeah, there is. There is today a market for all of those liquid fuels. There aren't conversion needs for building out the demand for that. So the assumption basically is we're one to build that project. It would have the ability to compete and fully sell all of its product in the market today. It produces jet, it produces naphtha, it produces fuel oil, and the volumes are such that it would are less than the relevant total market demand in Alaska. So you don't need to worry about ramp-up risk. However, I didn't focus on the coal-to-liquid stuff because in a lot of ways, if you think about it, it's almost impossible for that project to deliver energy cost relief. Why? Well, fuel oil, for example, is a commodity. And in the event that you had a state-sponsored project to sell fuel oil at below market rates, I encourage you all to join me in business because we're going to go out and purchase as much of that as we possibly can at those subsidized rates. And then we're going to turn around and sell them on the open market at market rates. That is, having price controls for a commodity like fuel oil is not necessarily something that's impossible, but is fraught with difficulty and encourages fraud. It's hugely problematic and raises an enormous set of regulatory and legal issues. I would also say that the coal to liquids project, it comes out on the bottom, but is faced with very substantial technological risk. It is an extremely large project. And assuming state funding, you're looking at trying to manage an extremely complicated project, much more complicated than, say, managing a pipeline project. Having that done by the state, I'm not sure that that's where our comparative advantage lies in terms of expertise. Finally, I will point out that the capital cost estimate associated with the coal to liquids project is the most uncertain of any of the projects. The uncertainty bounds are like plus or minus 40% to 50% at least.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Very good. Dr. Scott, thank you very much for this information. It was very informative, and Senator Coghill was right. You're quite an expert in this topic. Thank you very much. With that concludes our testimony today. We will be meeting on Friday, and we will have an overview of the Department of Natural Resources at that time. So at this time, the meeting is adjourned.